Just to set up the recording, today we're going to talk about Buddhism in its historical and global extent, or scope. So we're looking at a map of Buddhism as it stands today in its global distribution in the East. Obviously there is Buddhism in the West in a much smaller concentration. It'd be interesting actually to see a similar map in the West.
Mm. Yeah.
But here we are in the East. Now you can see that there are three main traditions there. There's the Vajrayana, Mahayana, and Theravada in the legend. So the earliest is the Theravada, and that is the earliest, if you like. Just like there is early Christianity, there is early Buddhism. And Theravada, if you like, goes back to the Buddha's time, or just after the Buddha. There was me one moment when I find my notes.
And what's the next oldest?
So the next oldest would be the Mahayana. So that was a reform movement. It was felt at one point that the Theravada was too focused on individual development, a bit too, I'm going to be all right, Jack, I'm going to get enlightened. So the Mahayana came along and said, it's really more about becoming enlightened in order to help other people, in order to change the world. So to direct the focus, to direct the motivation in an altruistic direction. So Theravada, let's just go back a little to the Theravada. That actually means school of the elders, and the image of saffron or ochre clad robed monks is probably familiar to you, like this one. This was on a pilgrimage to India in 2018 and a very special site called Vulture's Peak, where a lot of the sermons that the Buddha gave are placed, are located. So this was a really interesting bunch of monks on pilgrimage. They walked to all the holy places, so you'd see them in a long file on the road as we went along, chugging along in our bus, but we'd pass.
And this is India.
This is India.
And but then on your map there wasn't much Buddhism in India.
That's well spotted. If we go back, look at India. It's virtually it's one of the areas that is free, almost Buddhistless. It's free of Buddhism.
Buddhistless.
Less.
I like that.
So isn't that interesting, considering that's where the Buddhism originated?
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the really interesting aspects of the history of Buddhism. Buddhism, more or less, has disappeared from India. Maybe about 1.5% of the Indian population are now Buddhist.
Wow.
So we look at how come that's come.
Yeah.
That's one of the, well spotted. That's one of the key things we can see from this map. The real concentrations of Buddhism are, as you can see, China. So that's the later reform movement is mainly China, and Vajrayana, which was later again in history, and we look at the sequence of developments of each of these. But you can see the Vajrayana is there in Central Asia, Tibet, and also in Mongolia. They're the main concentrations of the Vajrayana. And we see that the oldest, old Buddhism, is there in where you might expect it, in Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar, or Burma. Also Sri Lanka. I think the monks that we've just seen in that photo, I think they were Sri Lankan.
Okay.
was going to say, well, I've been to Sri Lanka and I remember being taken to lots and lots of beautiful Buddhist temples there, although I was just like, oh, it's very pretty at the time. Yeah.
And did you see lots of monks dressed similar to those?
Yeah.
Whereas in Tibet, they I think they would be more in red and yellow.
Yeah, I've been to Tibet.
So, how do we get to this land? Oh, sorry, you can also see Japan. So the Mahayana is basically Zen. Zen is Mahayana. South Korea is Mahayana, or Korea generally. Taiwan. And interestingly, there's kind of a little spit of Mahayana in the... is it the Mekong Delta that's... or maybe I'm mixing up my geography. Whatever that land mass is with Thailand, Cambodia, you can see Vietnam, strangely, is a little spit of Mahayana in the midst of mainly Theravada, old Buddhism. Mm. So how does this map come to be? First of all, maybe just a few words about the three traditions. I haven't said much about the Theravada, Mahayana and Vajrayana, just to distinguish them. So Theravada is the oldest, it's the school of the elders, and it traces its origin back to the first Buddhist council, which happened just months after the Buddha died. So it started, or traces its origins back to the first Buddhist council, which started just after the Buddha died, 3 months after the Buddha died. So basically the Buddha died and a word went out, let's all come together and see how we can consolidate the teachings of the Buddha. So the monks, 500 monks came together and they formalized the, what's called the Vinaya, which is the practice of all the rules that the monks had to follow. So the monk, to become a monk, you had to follow certain precepts. So it wasn't just the five precepts that we looked at, it's something like 290 different rules they had to follow. All sorts related to, you know, practical rules to help them, to support them as monks. It was quite an exceptional lifestyle, isn't it, being a monk or a nun. So to support that exceptional lifestyle, they had all these rules, and they formalised those.
Obviously, you couldn't become a Buddhist monk before Buddha was around. So, but those were monks that were only become monks in his lifetime.
Yes, 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 for sure. But there were orders, there were monks in different traditions before the Buddha came along. So it's not like the Buddha just came up with the idea of monks being in a community and living together.
But there weren't any Buddhist monks before the Buddha, obviously.
No. Yes.
So they were different religions.
They would have been monks in the Dantic tradition and the Shaivist tradition. I'm not sure if they actually called themselves monks. I'm not sure what term they would have used.
And what sort of religions are those?
Hindu. We'd call them Hindu now. But Hindu is also a modern term.
Right. And they would have worn robes and...
Normally they would have worn something that differentiated them from the rest of the population, so that they were distinguishable. Mm. It's like when, you know, we saw the Buddha had his four sights, and the fourth sight was a holy man walking through the village. That holy man probably had some robe that distinguished them as a holy man. When the Buddha went forth and went on the start of his kind of search, his quest for an answer to the problem of suffering, he would have donned the robes of a mendicant. So they would have worn something to differentiate them from villagers, from householders.
Was this located in India?
This was so that was all in northeast India, so that would have been up around here.
Oh, okay. And that's where the Buddha was born, that was from.
Yeah.
Well, of course, this isn't a modern map, so of course, probably you looked at maps at that time, you know, that we've created that, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you had there was a religious map of that period in time, then, you know, the country might look pretty different.
I mean, yes.
Because we've changed the shape.
We have.
West has changed the shape of every country.
Yes.
You know, we've
Bangladesh probably didn't exist.
Totally.
So
India didn't always. India was bigger. You know, the smaller it was.
Yeah.
So.
And the names are all modern.
Different.
Modern
Pakistan
names.
Didn't exist until.
Exactly.
Yeah.
After it got.
Yeah.
India got independence.
Yeah.
So we're superimposing on the geography, really.
Yes.
So, but we do know what was in those areas, what was going on in those areas, more or less. Archaeology informs us.
Yeah.
So when he was wandering around and spotted the holy map, it would have been a Hindu holy map.
Yes. Yeah. The using that term that we use nowadays.
Yes, effectively.
Yeah.
It made sense that it was the north of India because, as you said, and then there's such a kind of big still cluster of Buddhist population, you know, in Tibet and stuff, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
We look at as to why that is the case. I mean, I find it very interesting. Just to say a little bit more about Theravada, there are about 528 million, so half a billion Buddhists in the world. Half a billion. And 28% of them would be Theravada. So do you see the Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Sri Lanka. So they're the Theravadan home countries, if you like, where Buddhism is kind of the cultural religion. It's the dominant religion. So that 28% of the world's Buddhists are in those parts of the world. The Mahayana, that means the Mahayana, so that's the reform movement I mentioned, where it was about the first century BC. I'm jumping. What I should have mentioned is that with the formalizing of the monks' rules, they also recited the teaching of the Buddha. They had an amazing memory. They had trained themselves in those times. Because writing was not so prevalent, they taught themselves to remember text or speech. So they were able to trot out, by memory, the Buddha's teachings. So a particular individual, Ananda, was supposed to have an exceptional memory, and he was the Buddha's right-hand man, so he stayed around the Buddha, and he was there, as well as laying out the rules for the monks, he recited the Buddha's teachings.
What's his name?
Ananda. And that became, if you like, agreed upon. Okay, what you've just recited is the canon. That is the agreed teaching that we'll work with and we'll pass on verbally, orally, from generation to generation. So they weren't literate at that time.
And so what was the predominant language people were speaking? Was it Sanskrit?
In Northeast India, there would have been Sanskrit around, but that was the language of the intelligentsia and the literate. If you think of, let's say, medieval Europe, that would have been the Latin of their time. The local people would have spoken a language called Prakrit. It's a family of languages. So there were various dialects of Prakrit would have been there in Northeast India. And what we'll see is that in the first century BC, so that's 300 years after the Buddha died, 300 years after that first council, when writing was developed sufficiently for them to say, okay, look, we've been passing these teachings down orally for 300 years, let's actually just get them down on paper. They had to decide, well, what language do we use to put them down on paper? And they decided to use a version of the dialects of Northeast India, so the Prakrit, a particular version called Pali. They almost, you could say they kind of invented Pali. They formalized the dialects that were there in Northeast India. So they would have varied in different respects. So what they had to do was kind of bring them together and say, okay, these are the rules. This is the grammar. You know, it kind of pre-existed in those dialects, but they had to make it coherent. So in a sense, Pali, the language which they wrote the oral tradition down in, finally, in the first century BC or BCE, that is an invented language.
What?
So it's never kind of passed down over the breakfast table from parents to children. It was the language of the scriptures. Actually, the phrase Pali is shortened from Pali Basa, the language of the text. So it was deliberately put together to transmit the Buddha's teaching.
Mm. And in a form that ordinary people could sort of have access to, rather than Sanskrit, which would have seemed like they couldn't understand.
Exactly. That's exactly why they chose to put it in Prakrit rather than in Sanskrit. Because the Buddha's emphasis was, at various points, the issue was brought to him, should he not translate his teaching into Sanskrit? And as far as he was concerned, that was pushing it beyond the ordinary people, because Sanskrit was the...
Like in Christianity with the common prayer book, wasn't it? Lots of people were
yes.
having it in English, plain English rather than Latin.
And it was heresy, for some people it was heresy to translate the Bible into the vernacular.
Yeah, the priest wouldn't be quite so important.
Mm. You wouldn't have so much control.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, comparing the different approaches. So yes, I'm jumping back and forth here. So the Mahayana tradition, where you see there yellow, mostly China, Japan. So that really started in the first century BC, as I say, as a reform movement. Because of the population distribution, that 65% of that 500 million Buddhist practitioners in the world are Mahayana. The odd thing is, if you look at the Vajrayana there, you might think, maybe it should be 30% or so, or 40%. Adriana, but that doesn't stack up, does it? We've got 28% Theravada, we've got 65% Mahayana. So actually the Vajrayana is about 3.4% of Buddhists. For a massive landmass, you can see there. That's red, Mongolia and Tibet. But why do you think it's only 3.4%?
Because there's not many people living there.
Exactly. We're talking about Mongolia and we're talking about Tibet.
Yeah.
They are vast and wild, under very low population density areas, both. So even though they cover a wide geographical area, that's not a lot of people. So going back to the Mahayana reform movement,
can I just ask something?
Yes.
Professor, to point it. So what's going on? Tibet is this dotted line here.
Yes.
What's
is that China?
So that's China. That's Western China.
But is that red because they're Vajrayana?
Vajrayana. So yes, that's all Vajrayana. So again, those dots. The dots are. Modern countries, modern nations, which, you know, this religions don't necessarily follow the boundaries of nations, do they?
So a big chunk of China was a different type of Buddhism.
Is a different type of Buddhism
is
today? It's definitely yeah.
And there's a little bit in India. Is Nepal as well? Is that?
Yes, Nepal is largely Vajrayana as well.
Yeah.
So Vajrayana, I haven't really differentiated it from Mahayana. So it arose around the 6th century. It really took off as a reform movement again. And it was based on Tantra. So it's a tantric form of Buddhism. So it's very complicated. The Tantra developed as both Hindu and Buddhist, more or less at the same time. And they kind of cross-pollinated. They just... One, you know, the Hindus would come up with a ceremony and an approach, and obviously they met and talked about these things, because soon you find the Buddhists are using the same, obviously translated to a Buddhist perspective and context. And then the Buddhists come up with something, like yoga, they think, began actually amongst Buddhists, the sort of yoga that we think of in terms of the asanas. But then the Hindus kind of got a hold of it and started using it as well. So there was this cross-pollination going on all the time. Obviously, they were just friendly to each other, they respected each other, and they were happy to communicate and share spiritual ideas. It seems from this historical perspective that it was a vibrant, positive seedbed of religion, very creative. Vajrayana really took off in the 12th century, 12th, 13th century. There was another wave.
What's the word tantric?
So tantric, it's actually really hard to define. It's like a movement in both Hinduism and Buddhism that placed an emphasis on energy, or psychic energy, if you like. So it worked with symbols and ritual and chanting and mantras to kind of stir up one's energy. So it was quite focused on ritual. It took on board all the teachings from the Theravada and the Mahayana, and then added its own. So this is what you find in Buddhist reformation. You find, so the Mahayana took all of the Theravada and then added its own literature on top. So it was very creative. And then the Vajrayana did likewise. It was a later development again, and it took all the Theravada Mahayana and added its extra on top. So the Vajrayana was saying, look, you can get enlightened in one lifetime if you can really recruit all your energies behind your practice. Whereas the Mahayanas would have said, oh, you need to come back again and again, rebirthing, coming back again. And in each lifetime, you make progress, and eventually you get enlightened. But the Vajrayana said, oh, no, you can do it in one lifetime.
What should the Buddha do in one lifetime?
Well, it depends which tradition you look at. I think most traditions would say, no, that he had previous births, and that he gradually, over the previous births, developed his virtue, his karma. Yeah, karma being the merit you gain from acts. It's like a momentum, an ethical momentum that you carry from life to life. So in a sense, that's what goes forward. So you know, it's not a soul, but it's an energy or a momentum that it's carried from life to life.
And so before those bits went red, they would have been one of the other types of Buddhism.
I shall go through the sequence. I went to an exhibition at the British Museum a few years ago, and they had this wonderful little video, which very quickly, only 2 minutes, goes right through how all the colours change. So we'll have. I got onto them afterwards and said, "That's a brilliant map.
Yeah.
Any chance that can I have a copy?" And they said, "Yeah, as long as you're not using it for profit, if you're just using it for teaching, you can have it." So they gave it to me. So I'll show you that, and you'll see how dynamic and how each of the traditions ebbs and flows historically.
Amazing. But. Obviously, this is today.
So the question is, how did we get here? One thing I would say about how we got here is that it wasn't, and this is a bit of a contrast with other traditions perhaps, it wasn't by conquest and colonization that we got here. It was more like following trade routes. So, what do you think? You see that green dotted line? What do you think that might represent?
It's not the Silk Road.
It's the Silk Road, exactly. So a trade route. Mm. So Buddhism followed trade routes. So it wasn't, Buddhism was not brought into China via an army, an invading army. It followed the Silk Road from the 2nd century BCE. Buddhists followed and traded and brought their teaching into China. So what Buddhism did, when it went into another country, it tended to interact with whatever the local traditions were. So in China, Buddhism arrived in about 50 CE, so that's common era, so it's 50 AD. And Taoism or Taoism was the dominant tradition in China at the time. So the Chinese would have seen and interpreted and explored Buddhism through Taoist or Taoist eyes. So what comes out of that is a fusion of Taoism and Buddhism, or a Buddhism through Taoist glasses. And that becomes Chan. So, you know, it was the Mahayana. We see it's the Mahayana tradition went to China, and it was quite effusive, quite full of ritual, and very quite thought out, and lots of books on it. And when it merged with Taoism, it got totally simplified. They said, look, that's over the top in terms of intellectual rationalization. You need to just bring it down, simplify it, and then you get Chan, which is the predecessor to Zen. So if you think about it, Zen is very stripped down. That particularly appeals to the Japanese. But also in China, when Buddhism mixed with Taoism, Chan was the outcome. And basically they said, look, just meditate. Forget about all that scholastic study. Just meditate. I'm simplifying.
That's good though.
So Buddhism,
broad brushstrokes.
Buddhism, yes, broad brushstrokes. Buddhism could just mingle with other traditions, because it's not dogmatic really. It comes out of a practical approach, which is meditation and ethics. So the emphasis in Buddhism is on practice rather than doctrine. Therefore, it's quite flexible in terms of fusing with other traditions, other practices. We can see that in the West. You know, the mindfulness tradition is very much fusing with the Western love of evidence-based approaches. There is, though, some level of competition. So when Buddhism went to China, you would have had the Taoists and the Taoists saying, look, we're a bit suspicious of this incoming newfangled ideas. That's, you know, so there would have been a bit of argy-bargy, both in Japan, but also we'll see in Tibet when Buddhism arrived in Tibet, because you had the Bon, local Bon animist tradition in Tibet. When Buddhism arrived in about the 7th century in Tibet, while the emperor wanted to bring in Buddhism, some of his court would have been Bon practitioners, and to some extent they resisted Buddhism. But as time went on, what you got was a fusion again between Buddhism but the Bon tradition. And Tibetan Buddhism is the result of that fusion. It's a very colourful, ornate tradition, and it's alive and well today and distinguishable from the other traditions. The Dalai Lama is, if you like, the main figurehead for Vajrayana Buddhism, for Tantric Buddhism. Now, bear in mind that it's just 3.6% of Buddhists, of that 5 billion, of that half a billion Buddhists that are represented by the Dalai Lama, even though, of course, in a sense, he's a figurehead for the whole of Buddhism. But even strictly speaking, actually, it's only one tradition within five or seven sub-traditions of the Vajrayana that the Dalai Lama is the main man.
So are there other main mans and other...
Yes, so there's the Panchen Lama. Don't know, he's less famous compared with the Dalai Lama.
Dalai Lama's very famous.
He's the dude, isn't he, when it comes to...
Where is that one you just mentioned?
The Panchen, I think...
What area of the world?
I'm not sure, I think he might be in China. And I think that's complicated because, you know, the Chinese have kind of clamped down on, they control any tradition in China is controlled by the state, effectively.
Mm. Mm. Is it particularly Tibetan with all the prayer flags and the...
Yes.
Is that...
Yes, that's characteristically Tibetan.
Paul, I think, has that as well.
Yes.
And that would be the Vajrayana.
That's the Vajrayana Tantric Buddhism. So it's kind of a mixture of the animistic Bon and Buddhism as came from Northeast India. Now, so we'll come... This will give you a sense of the progression. So here we are. You can see the bar here. We're around 500 BC, so we're just looking at the Buddha's life at this point. I've just paused it. So we've, you know, Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, Kapilavastu, where he's brought up, Bodhgaya, where he's enlightened.
Which,
so Lumbini was where he was born, traditionally.
Right.
Kapilavastu, where he was brought up. That's where he had his palaces. That's where he went forth from there, and then he headed towards Bodhgaya, where is where his he was enlightened. Oops.
Press the wrong button.
Oh, it's starting again. Doesn't matter. Lumbini. Yes, all northern India. Kapilavastu, Bodhgaya. And Sarnath was where he taught the first sermon. It's where he taught the Four Noble Truths. Kuchinagara was where he died. Now, so this is after the Buddha's death. You, fairly soon after, you've got a very important figure in Buddhist history who is Ashoka. He was an emperor, and he was born around 300 BCE. Around 300 BCE. Lived to about 232 BCE. Now, Ashoka was part of the Mauryan Empire. His father, I think, established it, and he inherited it. And he went on to conquer most of India. And there was a particular battle in a place called Kalinga. And somewhere close to where you see Amaravati there was a kingdom called Kalinga. And they were particularly stubborn when it came to being putting up a fight against Ashoka. And he massacred them. So there was a massive battle, about 100,000 people died. This was a big scale. And it actually affected him when he saw all the dead. And he vowed never to have another, he vowed to stop invading other, he wanted to stop being a warrior, a king. He converted to Buddhism. So he had a rule of about 40 years of peace with no territorial conquest. He published Buddhist teachings that were the famous Ashokan rock edicts. So various pillars, various rocks were inscribed with Buddhist teachings around outlawing animal sacrifice, banning royal hunting parties. He listed a series of protected species. So you had a period of real peace in India. as a result of Ashoka converting to Buddhism.
Did
as,
he become vegetarian?
Well, I don't know, actually, it's a good question. But he'd had a lot to make up for.
Yeah.
You know, he killed a lot of people.
And that was around the time, like, on the timeline?
This is about, so you can see in the timeline then there were around 300 BCE, a bit closer now, probably about 270 BCE. So that Ashoka went on a program of building memorials to the Buddha. So in the first week I showed you some of the sites associated with the Buddha, and there were these Ashokan pillars and stupas, these massive mounds as kind of commemorating the Buddha. So there's the great stupa at Sanchi. That's a picture of the great stupa, which Ashoka built. And he also built a great shrine at a place called Amaravati. Now you can see the Amaravati marbles, a bit like the Elgin marbles. They are in the British Museum. So if you go to room 33A in the British Museum, you will see the great shrine marbles from Amaravati that were built. So Amaravati was built by Ashoka. I've yet to have do an outing to the British Museum. So they have various sections on Buddhism. I have seen one, but I haven't seen the Amaravati marbles.
Room
33. Room 33A at the British Museum.
Definitely going to have I love the British Museum.
Oh, it's a marvellous place.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's also kind of overwhelming how much was taken from other countries.
Yes.
It's shocking. It's like,
pilferage.
Part of it is like a kind of, you know, it's incredible, the preservation on a positive point, when, you know, but in other parts it's like, oh, it's terrible how much is, you know,
and
the pillage of countries.
Are they called the Ashoka?
The Amaravati marbles.
Amaravati.
But when you realise how much got ruined just recently, even in Syria, it was the goodness, there's some, you know, and there are preservation in some museums.
We'll just have a look at the Bamiyan Buddhas that were destroyed by the Taliban in 2001, I think. After being there since the 3rd or to the 6th century. Yeah, 2001, the Taliban just blew them up. So, just to show you... Oops, wrong place.
Because we didn't finish the timeline.
We haven't. We'll come back to the timeline. It'll start again, but probably no harm. So this is a set of caves that soon after Ashoka, these caves were built. They were constructed around the 2nd century BCE, the Ajanta caves. About 30 caves cut out of the rock. This is northeast India.
In Rajasthan?
Well, I've got Aurangabad down, so I could be, I'm not my... my.
So it looks very, I don't know if there's loads of places like this, it looks very, traveling in India a little bit, and it's very familiar, but there was a great massive stone Buddha in one part of it.
So that could well be here, or it could have been the Ellora Caves, which are close by. The Ellora Caves are very interesting insofar as you've got a mix of Buddhist, Hindu, and Jain, all mixed up in different parts of the same complex. So they kind of coexisted. That's the wonderful thing about parts of India. You know, these traditions just coexisted. And also, this is worth just saying, this is around this time you had an area called Mathura, and we'll see these on the timeline map. And a very distinctive style of Buddhist art arose out of Mathura in the 1st century BCE. Okay, let's go back to the timeline. Now, it'll probably start again. It's a quirky thing. Yeah. So there we go again. Then we have Ashoka coming along, Amaravati, Sanchi and Mathura, Ajanta and Ellora, the caves. Were you in that part of India? You must have been, if you have.
Yes.
And now this happens as a result of Ashoka conquering the whole of India, basically, and for the northwest. Buddhism just spreads like a wildfire. Into modern day Pakistan, the Swat Valley, into Iran, as far as Iran, and modern Afghanistan. So this is how the Bamiyan Buddhas came about in the 3rd, 6th century, in sandstone cliffs. So maybe I'll just... So this was an image of one of them. One of the statues was 53 meters tall. The other was 35.
That person at the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And that puts a scale on it, doesn't it?
And is that still there?
That's what it looks like now, unfortunately.
Oh no.
It was they got artillery and just blasted it to bits.
No.
Sorry, but it's quite speedy, isn't it?
Yeah. Look at it again to try and remember.
So the Buddha's time, then Ashokan time.
And that little patch of Buddhism that spread.
And then, like, the whole of his kingdom was basically Buddhist.
Because he'd conquered everybody, he didn't have much choice.
Yes. I think so. Now what we're seeing there is Mahayana, and as you see the writing on the left, Mahayana, a new tradition, travelled along the Silk Routes to East Asia. So it seemed to Mahayana, for whatever reason, really to seem to have traction in China. So it's exploding in that easterly direction. So you can see it's taking over. Now you can see we're around 400 CE, so we're into this millennium. Dunhuang Mogua is another series of caves. I mean, the Chinese did it in style or volume. So there were about 30 caves around Ellora. There were thousands, I think, in Dunhuang. Let me see. It's a huge number. There was about 1,000 years of Buddhist art in Dunhuang. 492 caves, and the art, if you like, it's like a compendium of 1,000 years of Buddhist art in Dunhuang. It must be amazing to go there, spend time. So there, there are a lot of middles of nowhere in China. Exactly. Yeah, but okay, now things are beginning to happen. So we see the Mahayana's really travelled into China, and we're around the 6th-7th century. So what's happening now is the Vajrayana is coming out of Nalanda. So the Tantric Buddhism. It's coming from a hotbed of this huge monastery. It's like really impressive nowadays. They've only excavated a tiny section of it. It's like a whole city that was a monastery. There must have been thousands of monks there.
Wow. And where is that? Sorry.
So this is northeast India, Nalanda.
In Nalanda?
Yeah. Oh. So it was a hotbed of Vajrayana or Tantric Buddhism, and you can see it spreading out from Nalanda, right across into Tibet. But interestingly, traditional Buddhism, early Buddhism, is the Theravada is retracting from the west, and you can see the Vajrayana is extending out into Tibet, into the Himalayas.
Nothing
crossing
Japan yet. Oh, just
now. So we've got through the Korean Peninsula, we've got Buddhism arriving in Japan. And as I say, Chan Buddhism, that stripped down version of Buddhism in China, once it arrives in Japan, becomes Zen Buddhism. Chan just means meditation, really. So Zen really just means meditation. We also see down here that Buddhism has arrived in Myanmar, actually, and Sri Lanka. But actually, that has happened. I think there's some quibbles I'd have with this map. I think they actually happened BCE, the Buddhism arriving in these places. I'm not sure why it's happening so late on this
map. Late, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Down there, around, you know, Thailand.
So we can see that, again, early Buddhism is contracting, the Mahayana is filling in, and the Vajrayana is filling in where early Buddhism, Theravada, really was. Meanwhile, yeah, we see Buddhism expanding to the east. We also see Buddhism arriving in Indonesia in the form of the Mahayana. So Buddhism is consolidating itself in various institutions in Tibet. Now look what is happening. Buddhism is really still contracting here, but if you look where we're at, the 8th to the century to the 10th, do you know what's happening in that period, in that part of the world? Pakistan, Afghanistan, Islamic invasions are happening.
Yeah.
So the blue, the encroaching blue there is partly as a result of Islam invading, or Islamic traditions invading. Now, but we do see the Theravada growing here. So, but there is an expansion of Vajrayana still. And suddenly, Vajrayana just explodes into Mongolia. I think this is following Genghis Khan. I think he might have had some, or post Genghis Khan, there might have been some favourable attitude towards Buddhism, which allowed Buddhism to really thrive in Mongolia.
Why was it?
So again, under the pressure of... Okay, there are several reasons. One of them I've mentioned is the Islamic invasion. But it wasn't all because of external pressures. Apparently, the Theravada, the monks, got very isolated, insulated in their monasteries, lost contact with their communal support base, they lost popularity. So alternative traditions like Jainism and the Shaivist or the Nantic, what we would call Hinduism, became far more popular. There was competition between those traditions and Buddhism. There would have been absorption of Buddhism into those traditions. So that's those different processes, partly, you know, also schisms going on within Buddhism. So they didn't do themselves any favors on the one hand, but also, you know, they were being pushed by Islam. Islam was quite brutal too. For example, that Nalanda monastery was pretty much. I have heard that it was pretty devastating, that people was burned. But then, you know, what we saw when I was there, that they have excavated an awful lot. But maybe, I don't know. I need to look into that. I have a sense that Islam was quite destructive of Buddhism when it came across it. So yes, it's quite stark, isn't it? So this is why we see modern day India has very little Buddhism. We see the Theravada expanding through the
This
delta.
Isn't just monks, this is everyday people.
Yes. Yeah. As if you go to Thailand, there are monks, but there also are the everyday people are practitioners. Yeah. And there's kind of a symbiosis between the monks and nuns and the people, that there's a relationship of teaching and the people give gifts and support the monasteries and send their children to some extent to the monasteries for education or becoming monks. So we're coming close to modern day, so this is going to contract significantly. We're kind of heading towards the modern map, but you see the Mahayana is strong where the Vajrayana contracts. And we've got that, what, modern day kind of conglomeration of Theravada, early Buddhism.
Interesting that it expanded down significantly into Indonesia,
which
is quite isolated, and then, you know, and then retracted.
Yeah.
Really only leading Bali, and Indonesia is such a kind of, you know, really Islamic country.
Yeah.
But quite funny that they were so isolated that, you know, you would have been pull and push of different religions.
I think another diagram actually shows the complexity of the movements here. So it's not intuitive what the movements historically. So if you look at Indonesia, Buddhism came down from Nalanda, what I was describing as in northeast India, that big monastery. It was people from there coming down to Indonesia.
Mm, right.
Rather than gradually coming down through Thailand.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So it's quite a complex series of movements there. And those lines are thematic in terms of what the red is Vajrayana, and then the black is Mahayana and Theravada. And you can see why that strip or spit of Mahayana was there in Vietnam. You can see Buddhism is coming down in those red and black lines along the east coast of China, which would have been Mahayana.
Like, would have been a trade thing?
I don't know that much about Buddhist history. I'd love to study it in more detail, because there must have been all these overlapping reasons for Buddhism moving in that complicated pattern that we see there.
To really sort of take hold in a new country, you need to have a decent amount of monks with all the proper.
A good base.
Not just like ordinary people.
It must have been patronized by particular rulers. So that's what happened in Tibet. For Buddhism to arrive in Tibet, the Trisong Detsen, the emperor around 760 AD, CE, wanted his core to become Buddhist for whatever reason, and he brought in teachers from Nalanda, like Padmasambhava.
Oh, really?
And they were skillful in introducing a form of Buddhism that took account of the existing Bon tradition and expressed things in their symbolic language so that it had traction with them.
Yeah.
It spoke their lingo. Okay, resuming into the West, Buddhism arriving in the West, so this map is no longer valid. So the dude on the right there is Sangharakshita, who founded our tradition, and he's with a Tibetan Lama on the left, who is Dilgo Khyentse, very famous Tibetan teacher. So
what
maybe
name,
Dilgo Khyentse. Maybe just going back a little in time, in the 19th century, you had lots of translations of Buddhist texts going on. Particular German academics specialized in translating from the Sanskrit and the Tibetan. And there was a great flowering of interest really in the East. And you had some traditions like theosophy, a spiritual tradition that really found inspiration in the East, Eastern traditions, particularly Hinduism. And then, of course, in the 60s, you had an explosion of popularity of Eastern mysticism and yoga. So you had invitations going out to Eastern practitioners. You know, the Beatles were into, I can't remember his name,
Maharishi.
So you'd quite a spread of Eastern traditions. You had Zen became popularized in the US, so the beatniks really latched on to Zen. So Kerouac, Snyder, Ginsberg.
Well,
the beat poets, they certainly embraced Zen.
Yeah. And with the, just with the whole Beatles thing, 60s, the Hare Krishnas, what's that got to do?
So Hare Krishnas, Krishna is a Hindu god.
Yeah.
So they venerate the Hindu god Krishna. So it's a Hindu tradition, the Hare Krishnas. Mm. Yeah.
Nothing to do with it.
No.
But they do wear that similar colour.
They do. Yeah. They do. Yeah. And I think they shave their heads as well.
They definitely do. And when you go to, I went to that temple place out in wherever it is, the George Harrison one. And it's very, having been to a couple of Buddhist countries, it's very, the ritual, it seemed like you were in a Buddhist ceremony, and it's quite interesting.
Don't forget, Buddhism came out of a Hindu tradition. So it was immersed in Hinduism. The Buddha, if you like, came out of the Hindu tradition. Another development that is evidenced here is in the late 50s, the Chinese invaded Tibet, and also you had the Cultural Revolution. So as a result of both those movements, you had quite an exodus of Tibetans, particularly Buddhist practitioners leaving Tibet, and they risky journey over the Himalayas to generally arrive in Northeast India. So the Dalai Lama fled Tibet. That's how Sangharakshita met Dilgo Khyentse. So Sangharakshita,
the chap on the right.
He was a British soldier at the end of the Second World War, demobilised. He tore up his passport, and with a friend, he had come across Buddhism in London, read various books, and had decided he was a Buddhist. And when he went to India, was assigned to India, he thought, yes, an opportunity for me to get ordained as a Buddhist monk. So he wandered India trying to find a teacher, someone who would ordain him. Eventually he found one, and his teacher said, look, serve Buddhism in a town called Kalimpong in the northeast of India. And a lot of the Tibetan exiles found their way to Kalimpong. So he serendipitously encountered a lot of teachers, Tibetan teachers. So he was ordained as a Theravadan monk. So he had that combination of the early Buddhism, and then these Tibetan teachers started arriving. So he had the Theravada as well. And there were other teachers like from the Mahayana tradition in Kalimpong as well. So he just ended up in a place where a lot of the different traditions were represented. So he managed to pick up, and in the 20 years he was there, he picked up quite a broad knowledge of Buddhism. And then in the late 60s, he came back to the UK, of course, into swinging 60s London, a time of lots of experimentation. And he founded a movement. And his aim was to frame Buddhism in a form that would be palatable to Westerners. And he picked from the different traditions that he was familiar with, the Zen, the Vajrayana, the Tibetan, and the Mahayana, and the Theravada, the early Buddhism. So in 68, he founded the art tradition in 1968. At this stage, it has about 2,000 members, maybe a bit more. And by this stage, about a third of the members of our movement, if not more than a third, are in India. Because when Sangharakshita was in India, he met Ambedkar, who was a very interesting leader in India. He was probably the most educated, some people regarded him as the most educated Indian. He had doctorates from, I think it was Cambridge, and some American, one of the top American,
Harvard.
I think it was Harvard, he had a PhD. He was a lawyer. And he led the commission that drew up the Indian constitution in 1948 when India got its independence. And he was a Dalit. He was born into the lowest of the low, but he found sponsorship at different stages. So he's very exceptional in getting an education as an untouchable, was our scheduled caste, I think they were called, the bottom rung of society. And his passion was to better the situation, the conditions for people in his caste, because as you know, Hinduism has its caste system, which places you in a very particular and unmovable location in the in the pecking order, and the only way he tried various reforms in law, and in the end he gave up and decided that India was just too given over to the caste system, and he decided to convert to Buddhism. He did a bit of a survey of different religions as to which one he would convert to, so he converted in 1956 with his followers, and they were about 350,000. So just overnight, you had 350,000 Buddhists who didn't really, they weren't well educated because they were of that caste, but they depended on him. So and then he died later, about 6 months later. He worked himself into an early grave, and Sangharakshita started teaching the Dalit community. So there were mass meetings of tens of thousands where he would teach, because it's an odd mix of a social movement as well as a religious movement. Really, they converted in order to get away from the oppression of the caste system. So it was a part political social move, but it was under Ambedkar, it was very definitely to be a Buddhist as well. So the idea is, you become a Buddhist, you free yourself from the caste system, and you gain respect for yourself. So a result of that, anyway, is that a third of our movement would be the Dalit community in India.
So what was the name of that community?
With Dalit, I think Dalit means where you were a Hindu and you've converted to Buddhism.
And is that still today?
Yes. So I think it implies ex untouchable, but I'm not sure. Language is sensitive and all these. I think they prefer the term scheduled classes or scheduled castes rather than untouchables.
And what's the connection between that tradition and, he obviously taught there, but that's a different tradition, is it?
So the Dalits are not a tradition as such, they're not a Buddhist tradition. Maybe you could say they are, that it's more a political movement, that the Ambedkarites, they're called.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the Dalits who converted with Ambedkar were just left without a teacher, basically, when he died. And Sangharakshita was quite influential in teaching. So over the decades, a lot of them have ended up through schools. So one of the initiatives that Sangharakshita has set up was a charity that funds schools mainly in and hospitals in India, channeling funding from mainly England to India. So through those schools, a lot of Indian Dalits would, ex-untouchables or ex-scheduled castes, would come into contact with our movement and they get involved. And so as a result of that, quite a few are now order members. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. I think I'll read the notes.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
I mean, it does, yes, it does, yes. I'm thinking, I'm thinking to myself, sorry, didn't want to hold you up, but I was thinking, wonder why you feel like you have to invent a new tradition with all sorts of bits to make it palatable to Westerners when...
It's a good question,
It sounds quite palatable already, the what... I don't know, I just kind of...
If you walk
quite
into...
quite egotistical to up your own tradition. I don't know if that's the wrong thing to say
now.
Yeah. I mean, if you walk into a Tibetan hall with all the Tibetan colour, or if you go into a Zen and with all its stripped downness, that can be, oh yeah, I like this, the aesthetic and the stripped downness, or it might be, well, this is a bit odd, you know. So he obviously felt that he could bring together his knowledge of Buddhism and cherry pick, if you like, the bits that he thought would be more palatable. I can go through what they are, the characteristics of our tradition, what he decided these are the bits that fit together to make a...
But the things you've been teaching us on this course aren't that.
No. They are really mostly Theravada, early Buddhism. But you see, our tradition is very respectful of the Theravadan tradition as the foundation of Buddhism, really. Everything comes out from that later on.
In a way, because it's so embryonic in the West, it's probably no different than a division of Christianity, like, I don't know, Baptists.
Yeah.
You know, just deciding how to create a kind of a follow, you know, a combination of things that perhaps is going to be palatable.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, that has happened throughout religion, factions, and
for sure.
You know, and also just thinking, well, you're taking it from a really early, this is my understanding, you're taking it from a really different type of society, you know, in the East, and bringing it back to here is, you know, it makes sense. I can understand why you might want to
to hear that it's got all those traditional elements. It's not like he was sort of making up a new version.
Yeah.
No, he wants to take bits from his knowledge of the traditions he had come across. He was quite keen on being faithful to the traditions that he learned.
Will you be telling us a bit more about those traditions?
Yes, I can do that now. But before I go on to that, he's an interesting character in himself. So he died in 2018 at 93, 94. He's a controversial figure. I'm not sure if I've already mentioned this. He was gay, and he fell in love with various students of his, and he wasn't respectful of the boundaries that should really be there between teacher and student, and some of his students that he fell in love with and had relationships with were hurt when he stopped the relationship. So, you know, it was all consensual and you know, they were all adults. But there is a line which a teacher and a student should, well, at least a teacher has a responsibility not to cross
mm-hmm.
with a student, and he didn't honour that in quite a few cases. So that's where there's a controversy around him and his behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think he was a genius.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to understand Buddhism, his exposure to it, his learning, and then his ability to pass it on. But he was a flawed genius in my
mm-hmm.
my view.
Especially in that kind of spirituality, leadershipy thing, because who knows, people would be looking to him a bit sort of guru-y, you know, that sort of like, oh, you know, that they know something that you kind of, and to, it's all very well happening once or twice.
It's so not an equal relationship.
Yeah.
And it's gonna end up
very
in tears,
easy to,
I think.
Yeah.
Inevitably. So I can bring a bit more in on that, the guru-disciple relationship, in describing the characteristics of Triratna. So what distinguishes it? The first thing is that he didn't want to have a kind of a distinction between the monk and the lay. He wanted it to be neither monk nor lay. So he wanted ordination to be the key event, but that is flexible enough to accommodate whatever your circumstances are, whether you're married, whether you have a family, whether you're single, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're trans. He wanted the ordination to be, if you like, the central. Well, he wanted ordination to be an expression of commitment. So commitment to the teaching is really the primary, it's what makes you a Buddhist, really, commitment to the teachings of the Buddha, rather than a style, a lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
rather than being a monk or a lay person.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted
yes.
the emphasis to be on committing to
yes.
the precepts, and study the teachings.
And just an interesting point for me is you know, that he did that, but so traditionally where he would have seen Buddhism in India particularly, to be, do you call it ordinated? What do you call
ordination?
It? Ordination.
Yep.
You would have to become a monk, you called a monk.
Yeah.
And is it only men?
In the Buddhist tradition, it's both men and women, but it's very unequal, generally.
Yeah.
But in our tradition, it's totally equal.
Yeah, no, but I'm thinking traditionally, yeah.
Traditionally, there's, I don't know, at some point, there were nuns at the time of the Buddha, but at some point, one of the traditions lost their continuity, and they had this big thing about continuity. It had to be passed on from nun to nun rather than.
So you're talking about Buddhist nuns?
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't say female Buddhist monks, there's no such thing. They call them nuns.
They call them nuns. Yeah.
Oh, I thought. And this is only because I watched The Chef's Table with a female Buddhist monk in it, and I thought they were called monks as well.
Maybe there's a tradition. I haven't come across a tradition that calls them female monks.
And so, sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
that was just a thought that flew out of my mouth, sorry.
And did the Buddhists have any teachings or, you know, it was seemed to be kind of catch on with men more than women? You don't see sort of like, seems quite male dominated.
It is, I mean, as in probably most religions in the world are very male dominated. So
you would have thought Buddhism of all things is about the person not revering a male god, you know.
Yeah. And certainly our traditions is, as I say, is totally an equal footing for men and women. but we live in a patriarchal and patriarchally influenced world, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately Buddhism has reflected that.
Is it changing in some of the predominantly Buddhist countries?
I think they're very conservative.
Mm. Mm. So you wouldn't send your daughter off to be join the monks and become a nun necessarily, but it's unusual.
Again, I think it varies between the different traditions.
Mm.
I think some of the traditions, they don't have nuns. In others, they do.
Mm. Just remember.
Also, there could be a certain tradition where only the men can become monks and be ordained, and women, there's no place for.
I think in the Theravada, that might... No, that can't be true. I have met a Theravadan nun.
And they wear the same robes, do they?
I think they do, yeah. I'm not that au fait, actually, with which traditions have the possibility of nuns being ordained and which
certainly
don't.
In that picture, there wasn't any women.
No one at all.
Mm.
And you live separately, I guess, if you're ordained. I'm imagining it just being like...
Well, you see, on a practical basis, so if you become a monk, most monks take celibacy. It's almost part of the definition of being a monk.
Did
or
the
a
Buddha
nun.
Decide that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So celibacy was not an option if you were becoming a monk. And you can see why, and say they didn't have contraception in his day. So if you were committing yourself to... the spiritual life and the full time, you know, if you're going to have children, the two, certainly in those days, were difficult to combine.
He did, before he went on his trip, he didn't have any children back at
he
the
did,
palace.
He actually did, before he, back at the palace,
he
basically had it all, anything he wanted he had back at the palace.
So
he
left his children behind.
He left a child and partner behind. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Again.
Doesn't seem very kind.
No.
Just saying.
No, I'm
I think he might be flawed.
The Buddha was definitely flawed. I mean, he had six years of rambling. Okay, he was training, but he wasn't a saint. That's, well, he achieved enlightenment six, seven years later. So he was a flawed individual. Up until, I suppose that's one way you could put it, up until he was enlightened, he was a flawed individual. I mean, the story goes that his wife Anne became a nun down the line in his... community, and his son became a monk down the line. But yes, it's a question when he left stole out from his father's palace, leaving his wife and child behind, abandoning them. You couldn't condone that.
And in Buddhist teaching, sorry, Tikka,
these are good questions.
But in Buddhist teaching, is there any, you know, like in, well, in the Buddhist teaching, did the Buddha give any thoughts on gay, you know, relationships or anything like that? Was it just like, if you're going to become a Buddhist, I mean, it's one thing becoming a Buddhist, it's another thing becoming a Buddhist monk.
Mm.
So,
they are different.
Did the Buddha think just to become a Buddhist and go about your everyday business, you could?
Oh yeah, there were enlightened. There were enlightened householders or lay people.
Really?
In the Buddha's followers, and amongst the Buddha's followers.
So then you didn't just have to be a monk to get enlightenment.
To be a monastic, you had to, but not necessarily to be
a monastic.
So to become a monk, you had to take on celibacy.
Okay, yes.
It was kind of part
of
the turf.
But you could reach enlightenment either way.
Yeah.
And that's because you were due it in this lifetime?
Or just talented, perhaps.
Okay.
The sense that you're going to make your life easier to practice if you haven't got distractions. I mean,
well, that's a shame for all the people who became monks and then didn't reach enlightenment.
Well, I suppose if they were happy.
Sure.
I mean, hopefully you'd stop, if you were unhappy as a monk, you'd stop being a monk. You had the option, you could disrobe and stop being a monk and return to your family life. There's always the option of just leaving, disrobing.
Do you need to carry on to get to the end of this?
Questions are good. I think then they're relevant, aren't they? What I'm saying is directed towards what is on your mind.
Okay. I'd like to know the concept of enlightenment. I realise there's reams of things about what that is, but in a simplistic sense, like in a monastery full of monks, you know, how common is it or was it for someone to, and did they the ones that decided, actually, just last night, I've got to tell you, I reached enlightenment. You know, how does it come about?
I don't know. I'm not sure if I've met an enlightened person. At the first council after the Buddha's death, there were supposedly 500 enlightened individuals at that council. People would say that they've, over the centuries, there have been lots and lots of enlightened people. I'm not sure what defines exactly. Well, theoretically, I know what defines, but I'd hope an enlightened person is certainly very kind, very wise, and ethical. I suppose they would be the hallmarks of enlightenment. But if a person claims to be enlightened, I've certainly met people who've made claims, and they haven't.
But
could
one person believe that they've experienced enlightenment? I'm not sure what they.
Be deluded, couldn't you?
Yes.
You could have an amazing experience that, and suddenly have great clarity, and think, "Oh, that's it. I've reached it." I think you'd really have to test it out and see whether you really are free of greed, hatred, and delusion in all your thoughts, in your speech, in your actions. If you found you were completely free of greed, hatred, and delusion, that's more or less enlightenment, really. If you have transcended that sense of a fixed, separate self, and all the consequences of that, so you won't suffer, because in the sense of the secondary suffering that we talked about, you're not going to suffer, because there is no sense of an attachment to a self that is going to be the one who suffers, the one who gets insulted, the one who loses things. That sense of that identification with one's experience, with one's things, is gone. So
what the greed, hatred, and delusion? What was the thing about delusion?
Delusion is ignorance, spiritual ignorance.
Yes, right.
And the primary spiritual ignorance is that sense of a fixed, separate self.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you're only likely to reach enlightenment if you are wandering around on your own without any possessions, without, you know.
Maybe just if you can make use of the circumstances that family life provide, you know, that how you deal with that screaming child at 3 o'clock in the morning for the 20th night in a row, you know, if you have the resources to really meet that situation, maybe that could even be the source of your progress, because you know that would really require amazing resources to respond. So can you respond to the situations that life throws up with kindness, with wisdom?
It's a bit of a big question, but maybe it's the next course. But what do Buddhists believe happens when you die?
So that's a good question. And there is
coming it all in tweets.
I mean, put it, one way of describing it is your karma, the momentum from how you've been in this life carries forth into the next life. That's one way of, so you, it's not like a soul does, but it's like there's a karmic momentum goes forward, an energy.
Similar to a soul, do you
say? But it's a process, it's not a thing, it's not fixed, it's constantly, so it's a condition on the basis of which something happens, something else falls on.
Karma will be reapplied in life again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you, if somebody reaches enlightenment, does that mean they don't get reincarnated again?
Yes. Although there's an option. So in Tibetan Buddhism, there's an option. So you can choose. Okay, that's it. I've burnt up my karma. I'm enlightened.
This is as good as it gets.
This is as good as it gets. Nirvana, or else for the benefit of all beings. So I've achieved this level of insight and kindness. So I can help other people. So I don't want to kind of say it. You know, that's it. I want to come back and be reborn so that I can benefit other beings. So there's a whole tradition. The Mahayana brought in this tradition where you stay around for the sake of all beings. So the Dalai Lama, that's his tradition. That particular Tibetan tradition would have this sense of lamas coming back again and again in order to teach.
Okay. So the Dalai Lama say that he may not come back.
I think he did, didn't he?
So that he's decided that he's
decided
that he's gone back.
I've done,
and that's why wouldn't have normally come back, because he's achieved enlightenment, but he's chosen to come back because of this extra
possibility that I'll benefit, I'll play more of a role in benefiting the world. And
So is the whole point of it that, like, so reaching the top of a mountain, it's like irrelevant in a way. If you wanted to keep coming back, you wouldn't want, if you believed it sort of stopped at enlightenment, and this, is it a state of being called nirvana, would you say?
So the problem is just using the language that we, conceptual language, to describe a condition.
Whatever it is.
There's a sense in which it's not static.
Yeah.
You know, from our perspective, it seems like you've reached that attainment, and
like
that's you've got the certificate, you've run through the ribbon, you've got the t-shirt, but there's a sense in which it can't be a static thing; it must be a constant, still process.
And that in death, therefore, somebody who's become, well, two things I'm going to say. Really, one is, just as a Buddhist, it doesn't really matter if you. It's the journey. It doesn't matter if you get to your 90s and you're like, oh God, I'm not enlightened and I never am going to be. It's no huge, great disappointment. Is it presumably all about the journey going there, and nobody would expect to become enlightened in their lifetime, probably? I don't know this question.
Well, the Tibetans, the Vajrayana does aim to try and get enlightened. But the thing is, you can't, in a sense, if you have enlightenment as your goal, it's I've got this goal, but the very purpose of the path is to drop that sense of the I.
Yeah.
Mm.
So in a sense, you have to transcend.
That's what I mean. So therefore, it's all living it is all about being on the journey.
I think that's very true. Yeah. So it's about this is where I'm at, this is what I can do to be the best person I can be, and what happens, happens. It's like, this is my gift to the world, and what happens, happens. If I get enlightened, great. If I don't, great. Well, I'm glad we've covered that, because you were asking that question in week one, Susie, what is enlightenment? And in a sense, we can only dance around and look at it from different angles, because language can never quite do justice to a condition which is beyond us, in a sense. Maybe very briefly, the other characteristics of Sri Ratna that Sangharacharya decided, that these are the importance of friendship. So rather than have the traditional guru-disciple relationship, in Sri Ratna it's more based on a network of friendships. So you have friends who are more advanced or at least have more experience. You've got friends who are less experienced. You've got friends who are peers. So it's kind of a network. So there's less emphasis on the guru-disciple relationship. And that has developed over the years, which has been useful. And I think it's one of the reasons where the movement is resilient. So when, you know, it came out about Sangharacharya's behaviour, the movement was based on a network of friendship rather than him being the guru and everyone else being a disciple. So I know there are other traditions where there's a scandal around involving the guru, and it falls apart because of the sense of
it's the deterioration of the Catholic Church, isn't it? That's a classic example, isn't it? I mean, there's lots of reasons why Catholicism has diminished, but it hasn't really helped. There's been so much controversy around those people that you're meant to, you know, turn up every Sunday and.
Yeah. They're the teachers, the trusted.
And the ones you confess to, and the ones you know, slightly the gatekeepers, too, aren't they?
Other characteristics, and I've kind of covered these, that it's spiritually ecumenical, so it takes from the various lineages. Hopefully taking the kind of core teachings, the fundamental Buddhist teachings. It's a unified order, so equal ordination for men and women. There is, celibacy is an option. Some people who do choose to add, it's like an add-on to their ordination, they take a vow of celibacy, so it's an option. Another key aspect is the arts, a focus on the arts as a means of spiritual growth. That really, the imagination and art are another way of expressing the spiritual life. Maybe a bit like you were doing in your ritual.
Yes, I felt it very strongly.
So that's been a key. Writing, our visual arts, our music, there's a strong emphasis within our tradition on them as parts of a spiritual life. Social engagement is the final one I'll mention. So he had quite a teaching on the new society. He had a sense of Buddhist communities forming networks to affect the world. So there have been what he called right livelihoods, so people coming together on various projects, maybe vegetarian restaurants or whole food suppliers or gardeners. There have been a number. So Buddhafield, the one that the charity I worked for, that would be, the centre in a sense. I suppose the centres tend to try and work on the basis of developing one's spiritual life in the context of a working place. So we kind of check in each day and try and make sure that the activities don't clash with a sense of spiritual development, so that we're not overworking, but we do run the business part of, you know, aspect of the thing on an ethical basis, you know, honest, you pay your taxes, you don't fiddle at any systems, you treat people well, you have your various human resource, what's the word I'm looking for, staff well-being is looked after, safeguarding is looked after, all these aspects of an ethical business are topmost, are sustained, are, you know, kept in view, and at least you try and honour them. So that would be, they would be aspects of a right livelihood business. So these were
these things that he set out.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So they're the kind of the elements of what he wanted the true Atman to be. Distinguishing characteristics. I see it. We have hit 9:30. So let me. Do I have those sheets of activities that? I think they're upstairs. Bear with me one second.
So, just in terms of continuing. I've lost my language. Continuating.
I didn't even know. Continuating sounded fun.
Yeah. Continuity, I think.
I wanted to finish.
Yeah, I think that's what he was trying to say. Yeah. Continuity.
Gosh, it gives you a bit of a bad taste, that cut, finding out about that guy taking advantage of his position.
I know.
At least it was consenting adults.
Well,
yes. I wasn't going to ask their age.
No. But anyway.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cool. Good.
Thank you.
There's some
books
listed as well.
Thank you. Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, really good.
Thank you so much.
I hope I brought it all up to date in terms of...
Oh, that's so kind of you.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you.
That's such a good idea.
You can see the website, westlondonbuddhistcentre.com. If you go there, you can sign... Oh, yeah, just mention it. You can sign up for the weekly newsletter, so there is, if that is mentioned.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
It's been great.
I've really enjoyed these sessions, so thank you.
Great, yeah.
I've loved the questions, and that's what makes it...
Yeah.
Interesting, and the questions are relevant to you.
I think that's what made